This programme has been funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.
Welcome back to Heritage and Heroes. It's Dr. Alison Lennon here again, and today we are in Omeath, a beautiful part of County Louth, up along the northeast coast past Carlingford. It's actually a wonderful place to visit. It has a wee ferry that goes from here in the summer over to Warren Point. And it's a place, I've visited a number of schools here over the years, and there's a lovely sense of community here and a real interest from the children in their local landscape. Again, I am joined by Liam Gormley, who will interview me throughout our visit to our Dahi Primary School. This is an absolutely lovely wee primary school perched above Carlingford Lock, and it's always a pleasure to visit. How are you, Liam?
Hello. We're here in Ardahi in Omeath. Can you tell us about the area?
Thanks, Liam. Yeah. Omeath, as I said, is a lovely wee village located on the shores of Carlingford Lock. The thing about Omeath is that it's steeped in Irish history. I remember one time I had friends over from Scotland, and my parents, well, this is a long time ago, and my parents were driving us along, and we came to Omeath. And one of my friends said, "Oh, Omeath, is that an Irish word? What does it mean?" And I said, "Oh, it actually means town of one horse." To which everyone burst out laughing. But in a way, it was true. For a long time, Omeath was a sweet, quiet place you drive through. But now it's quite a lovely place to go as a tourist. And the history of the area is very, very interesting. It's got outstanding natural and scenic beauty. It's near the border between Louth and Down. And, you know, the native Irish speakers existed in Omeath until just before the middle of the 20th century. I only actually found this out recently enough. In 1912, Omeath was a Gaeltacht area, and the area had lots of native Irish speakers, as well as having its own distinct local dialect. They also had their own songs, poetry, and traditional customs. Coláiste na Bréid was a summer Gaelic college, which was inaugurated here in Omeath around, I think it was 1912. And it actually lasted until the whole sort of Gaeltacht moved to Ranafast in Donegal in 1926. Another thing about Omeath is actually that it was the site of some quite recent archaeological finds. I'm sure people in the area know about the proposal for a bridge at Narrow Water. And this led to an excavation which yielded some very significant finds, some of which dated back many thousands of years. For a while, actually, I remember when this was undergoing, there was rumours that a Viking treasure hoard had been found on the Narrow Water Bridge site. These were actually proven unfounded, sadly, but there were findings for Mesolithic and medieval settlements. The site of Corna Muckley was excavated in the summer of 2014, and they found the remains of an early medieval industrial site. Among the findings were two cereal drying kilns, a metalworking area, a series of pits of various sizes, hardened deposits cut by a post-hole line, and an overlying spread of charcoal-rich sands, which covered the majority of the excavation area, again leading to speculation this was some sort of medieval industrial site. Now, it's quite close, the site, to an early medieval monastery, and these newly discovered features may be directly associated. Maybe they were working together with the monastery, so it could actually be associated with this early ecclesiastical site. We're not sure. Bear in mind, Narrow Water Castle is across the water, but we don't actually think that had anything to do with this particular site. So, yes, to answer your question, Liam, it has a rich archaeological history.
I believe Omeath is also famous for its Mass Rock.
I find Mass Rocks fascinating. Actually, I think before we talk about the Mass Rock in Omeath, I'm going to talk to our listeners a little bit about Mass Rocks in general. They're also called Carrig and Afrin in Irish. And a Mass Rock was, as it says, a rock used as an altar in the mid-17th century in Ireland as a location for Masses, Roman Catholic Mass. Isolated locations were sought to hold religious ceremonies, as observing the Catholic Mass at this time in Ireland was a matter of both difficulty and danger. And this was because of Cromwell's campaign against the Irish and the penal laws of 1695. So what happened was bishops were banished, and priests had to actually register to preach under an act at the beginning of the 18th century called actually the Registration Act, I think. So we had priest hunters were employed to arrest unregistered priests and Presbyterian preachers, so it wasn't just priests, it was also preachers, under an act of 1709. So what was it? It was just a rock, but it wasn't really. In many instances, it was actually taken from a destroyed church, a church that had been knocked down, and they would take a large stone from a part of the church ruin, and it would relocate it to a rural area, and there would be a simple cross carved on its top. Because the activity was illegal, you couldn't actually schedule these services, so how the word got about was through parishioners who would spread the word around quietly. Pullabwy, which is the mass rock located near the school we are today, or Dahi School, is the only known mass rock in this area. But it's a very famous mass rock because in the millennium, around the millennium, the tradition of having a mass there was revived. It was actually the year 2000, instead of the millennium, and it was on the feast day of St. Lawrence, who's the patron saint of Omeet. And actually, it's continued. Most years since then, there is a mass. Up until then, the mass rock in Ardahi was not within reach to the general public. You couldn't actually get to it. And we believe the rock may have actually been taken from the ruins of a church. And this particular one had an indent, which was often the case, an indent in the middle, which must have been carved out in some way, where the holy water was placed. I visited the site. I've actually visited the rock here. There's something very evocative as you stand beside the rock. The scenery is breathtaking, but the site is quite desolate, and there's always a very stiff breeze there. If you close your eyes, you can imagine the fear, but the courage and the faith it took people to defy the penal law and come to hear Mass here. Like Bagnall's Castle in Uri, I love monuments which are still in use today, providing us with a sort of living history and a reminder of past lives.
Could you tell our listeners about one final archaeological monument that you would recommend they visit around Omeet?
Actually, that's very easy. There's a monument known as Clontigora, another great name. It's a magnificent but virtually unknown megalithic tomb, and it's situated at the flagstaff above Omeet and Carlingford. Locals call it the King's Ring, and it's actually a core tomb that has a prominent position in the south-east part of Slieve Gullion's ring dike. It was built for collective burial by, we presume, an early farming community who cultivated the land as long ago as 3500 BC. It doesn't look now the way it would have looked then. You know, it's a ruin. But despite damage to the structure, it is an impressive monument. And it is actually more extensive than when you first go up to visit it. If you take the time to look around, it's more extensive than it first appears. There are imposing tall stones. Some of them were nearly 3 metres tall. And these define the deep U-shaped forecourt. That's actually why we call these court tombs, because they had this forecourt. And this is where funeral rites were performed before the ashes or bones of the dead person were taken through the entrance into chambers. And this entrance is marked still by two massive portal stones. The forecourt may have been used for other ceremonies as well as for burial ritual. We're not sure. Roof slabs and a large capstone over the first of the three chambers are supported on enormous split granite boulders. It really is a sight to see. Strange thing, court tombs usually faced east, but the one here at Clontigory faces north towards a stream about 100 metres away. We don't know why, it's strange, but there you go. Now, in 1937, there was an excavation, and it showed that the tomb was originally covered by a small elongated cairn, or a pile of stones, flaring out around the courtyard. A cairn is a marker. You know, you see them all over Ireland, actually, and it is a pile of stones piled upwards over some sort of monument. Finds from the excavation here in 1937 were actually included cremated bone. There was flint artefacts, there was pottery, there was even a stone axe, and there were arrowheads. There were actually, as I mentioned, flint arrowheads. Now, it's not hard to find once you know where it is, and I know that sounds a bit Irish, but I had known about Clontigory before I'd ever seen it. I'd studied it when I was at college, and it did take me a couple of goes to find it. And then, of course, Dad stepped in, he knows everything, and he took me up. And once you know, as I say, where it is, no bother. It's easy to miss it the first time you visit, so you need to keep a close eye out. And the way I go is I take the first turn right past the Carrickdale Hotel. So you drive past the Carrickdale Hotel, and you take the first turn right. And you head up over the mountain, which, by the way, I'm sure you know, in itself is a spectacular drive. It's a wee gem of a drive. And you keep an eye out for a sign on the left, right-hand side. But if you keep an eye out as you sort of approach the top of the road, you'll see up over to your right a collection of big rocks. You can make out that it's some sort of a monument. And there's a path next to a bungalow, and you can walk right up. Actually, tell you what, my advice would be, if you go onto the Ring of Gunion website, look up Clontigory. There is actually a conjectural reconstruction of the tomb, and it gives you a great idea of how it looked before it became ruined. And if you look at that and then go to the site, it really helps you figure out where everything is and what everything is. And it really is worth a visit, as is Omeet itself. Hi everyone.
Hello.
We're out in Ardahi, which has the most beautiful view I've ever seen, right over Carlingford Bay. You're very lucky to be here in this school, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah? And behind us we have the lovely Cooley Mountains in Sleafoy, and then down into Carlingford Bay and Carlingford Lock. It's amazing. I'm so envious of you. So today we're going to talk about Omeet. We're going to talk about archaeology, and we're going to talk about this wonderful area that you're living in. So what's it like living out here in Omeet? Is it lovely?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say it's great fun, is it?
Yeah.
And this is a very, very old land. First of all, what's it like living by the sea? It's fun. Is it fun? Do you go down to the water much, guys?
Yeah.
And has anyone ever found any nice stones or fossils or flint on the beach? Have you ever? Because I've walked along the beaches around here and I found some lovely flint, thousands of years old. What about the ferry? Have you gone over to Wern Point or to...
Yeah?
And that's starting up again soon, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's already here. Has anyone gone over yet this year?
No,
but you can go over in the summer, will you?
Yeah.
So what do we think archaeology means? Will you come up and tell me, anyone that can sort of tell me what archaeology means? Now, this class is a great class. This is an Omeet. There are great talkers out here. So could you tell me, one of you, oh, here we have someone, and just what archaeology means to you, okay? And if you can talk loud into the microphone.
I think it means it's a person who finds strange artifacts and old fossils.
Old fossils, okay. So we're looking at things from the past, is that what you think?
Yes.
Could anyone, thank you very much. Could anyone tell me why you were interested in looking at things from the past? Okay, so the student there very rightly said we look at artifacts in the past. What is it we're trying to find out?
See what history was like in the past.
See what history was like in the past. See how people lived a long time ago. And people who study archaeology and try to find out about the past are called archaeologists. Can we all say that word? Archaeologist. Okay. And that's what I am. I'm an archaeologist. Okay. So, let's play a game, all right? I want you to pick up something in front of you, maybe a pencil case or a book, or look around the room and tell me, let's try and figure out how old things are. How old do you think a plastic bottle would be around for? What I'm telling you this for students is, when we find artifacts, archaeologists, we're able to date them to when they were around. So if we found, say, a sword, we could study that and figure out how old the sword is, because the sword has survived a long time. So we're going to look at some modern products and try and figure out how long they'd last, how long it would take them to rot, so the archaeologists may find them in the future. So the first thing we have is a plastic bottle. How long do you think a plastic bottle would last? So just, you think it'd be around for a long time?
I think it'd be up to 400 years old.
Excellent! 450 years old. It lasts for 450 years, maybe even longer, we're not sure, but at least 450 years. What about wood? Because then you can take a guess how long wood would be around for.
5 years?
Yeah, some wood, if it was only, say, a branch that was an inch thick, might last 3 to 5 years. But a log that was maybe 3 or 4 feet thick
might be around for 50 years, okay? Wood does eventually disintegrate. What about your eraser on your desk? Well, how long do you think the eraser lasts for? I'm talking about any type of rubber, really, but how long do you think it would be around so that in the future, when archaeologists found it, to be able to date it? How long do you think rubber would last for?
250 years.
250 years. Well, it would actually last, strangely enough. That eraser would last about 50 years. But I'm sure if it was a lot bigger, like a tile, it would be more like 200 years. What about plastic bags? Would anyone take a guess how long plastic bags would be around for? Okay. Now, remember, there's been a campaign in Ireland to use less plastic bags because they actually would be around for quite some time. How long do you think?
Well, they'd be around for about 500 years.
Excellent. 500 years to forever. We're not actually sure how long they'd last. What about a computer? Yes, can we figure out how long a computer and all the parts in it would last for archaeologists in the future?
Around a million years.
A million years. Well, actually, some of the parts would last about 1,700 years, but some of the parts might take forever to decompose. So yes, you could be right in a million years. What about tin cans, aluminium cans? How long do you think they'd be around for?
300 years.
300 years. Actually, aluminium cans, yeah, well, they're about 80 to 100 years. And then we've glass bottles. Now, there's something that would be around for a long, long time. Would anyone like to guess? Someone said the figure for something else a minute ago.
550 years.
550. Do you know a glass bottle would actually last a million years? How do we date things? Well, what we know about our past and the way people lived many hundreds of years ago is always changing. And this is because archaeologists, historians and scientists, we are always discovering new ways to date things, to figure out how old something is. And we can apply new methods of studying old objects to things that have been dug up for many years. For example, the famous sarcophagus of the child pharaoh Tutankhamun, which we're going to talk a wee bit more about in a minute, at the British Museum, was discovered in November 1922. But we are still studying it now. Even right up to date, 2017, we learn new things about Egypt and Tutankhamun himself because we're always discovering new methods to examine him. In 1949, a scientist called Libby discovered a way of working out how old objects are by measuring what is known as the radiocarbon date. Now, all of us, you children here, animals, plants, have carbon in them, and the carbon can be measured to figure out how old they are. The most important carbon, the carbon we use for dating, is carbon-14. And when we die, the levels of carbon-14 in our bones go down. So this allows scientists to examine anything that has carbon-14 in it and figure out how long ago they died. And this can work not just on us humans or on animals or on plants, but they can also work on clothing and furniture too, because they would have a trace of carbon-14 in them. When they, like for instance, your desk or any wooden desk, that would have carbon-14 in it because it was made from wood. So that's how we could tell how old the desk is. And this is another great word, my favourite word. Could we say this word? Dendrochronology.
Dendrochronology.
It's a big word, isn't it?
Yeah.
And basically, it's about tree ring dating. And it uses the patterns of growth rings in trees. And then when we have many types of woods, the tree rings that are formed can be dated to an exact calendar year. If it's very rainy, the rings will be wide. And if it's a very dry season, they'll be narrower. So we can tell about the climate of a season as well. Trees from the same region will tend to develop the same pattern of ring widths for a given period. So you see the trees there through the window behind you growing up the mountain. They would all probably have the same pattern of tree rings, okay, and ring widths. And then these patterns can be compared and matched ring for ring with trees grown in the same zone and under similar circumstances, similar climate. And then these tree ring patterns from living trees can be dated back through times, and chronologies can be built. So that's all a bit complicated. But what it means is that archaeologists have got a database that helps us understand how old something from wood is. We can date anything that's made from wood. Okay, archaeological facts. Archaeology is a science that studies past cultures and the way people lived based on the things they left behind. As we said earlier, it helps us understand not only where and when people lived on the earth, but also why and how they lived. And the things that people left behind are called artifacts. And archaeologists can tell a lot about people and how they lived by looking at their houses, their clothes, their bones, even their garbage. A garbage site, actually, in Midden, is one of the best ways to find out about the past, because we can look at artifacts within the Midden. Could anyone come up and identify for our listeners some of these artifacts? You see here, could anyone sort of, can you figure out what some of them are? Yes, can you go up and tell us and describe them to the audience? Up on top, there's a fair number of, what would you say was there?
Jewellery.
Jewellery, yes. We have torque bracelets, which are very well known in Ireland. We found a lot of them in the Bronze Age. We have combs. Again, made out of, some of these are made out of shells and some of them are made out of bones. And then we have a lot of coins, haven't we? Mm-hmm. Small silver coins. Thank you. That's great. And what about in the bottom here? Could anyone identify what we have here?
Like swords.
Swords, arrowheads and spearheads, which we find many, many of these in Ireland, okay? You know, I've actually found in the past, we've dug up sort of a hoard of little small arrowheads. And again, we can use radiocarbon to date some of these, some of our finds, like the combs made out of shell or whatever. That's sort of what our job is, to look at things left behind and to find out how old they are and what they were used for. So if we go down. And these are, if we look at here, we're going to talk about the fact that we have two types of archaeological sites. We have a prehistoric sites, and then we have historic sites. Now, a prehistoric site is one where the artifacts that are found are dated before people began to write, okay? Before we'd any written records. So that's what prehistoric means. And these sites are more difficult because scientists can't look up any other information. We can't go and look up the annals. We can't look up a book or an encyclopedia. In a prehistoric site, we can only go by what we find, okay, by the artifacts. However, at a historic site, archaeologists can look up information about the objects they found because historic means they started keeping records. So we can look at the artifacts and then look at the written records at the time and check what it is exactly that we found. Archaeologists dig in a scientific way with niche, organised square holes on a grid system. By doing this, they can record everything they find and where the items were found. Now, if you see these two pictures here that we have, these are two monuments, which we'll talk about in a minute. Does anyone recognise either of these monuments, what they are? Have a look here. Look at the first one. It's got a sort of cap sitting on top of some standing stones. And the second one appears to be some sort of a castle. Can you just tell us what you think we're looking at?
The first one is a dolmen.
Correct and right. And what was a dolmen used for?
I don't know.
It was for burying people, but it's excellent that you recognise that's what it was. And the second one is Narrowwater Castle. Have you guys been to Narrowwater Castle? It's just down the road from here, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a lovely wee castle. Okay. So excavation. Does anyone know what excavation means? No. Yes, can you come up and tell us what excavation? Because this is the main thing an archaeologist does, is she excavates or he excavates. What do you think that means?
When you dig something up and when excavate it.
That's it. That's perfect. It's digging. That's basically the fancy word for digging. When archaeologists, you can see here a picture of two archaeologists working on a site. You can see this grid system in the trenches. And when archaeologists are investigating a site, they carefully mark it out with a grid and slowly dig, removing the soil carefully. Why do they need to remove the soil carefully? Yes. Okay. Why do you think, guys, that we don't go out and use big... Now, we do use shovels to get rid of the topsoil, but why do you think it is that when we get near an artifact, we're not... bang, bang, bang with a shovel.
So we don't damage it?
So you don't damage any artifacts, exactly. So we use something else. Can anyone figure out what we might use? Yes? If you'd like to come up here and tell us. We don't use big, heavy shovels. we actually have another piece of equipment, another tool that we would use. Do you know what that's called?
A brush.
We use a brush. Why do we use a brush? What do you think you would use a brush for if you found an artifact?
To dust it off.
To dust it off. Very good. Can anyone else remember another tool that an archaeologist used? That again, it's not like a shovel. It's like something a wee bit more delicate.
A trowel.
Good man, good man. Well done. A trowel. Yes, we use a trowel, which is like something you put on cement with. You might see men on, or women on building sites putting on cement. And that is what they use it for. They use this trowel because we get them in all different sizes. And they can be very, very delicate. And it means that we don't break the artifact. Okay. When they find something, they gently remove the soil from around it until it is free to be lifted away. Then what archaeologists do is record what they found. They might draw a diagram or take a photograph showing where it is in relation to the grid. And then they examine what it is they found. And many objects need to be carefully cleaned. We get the brush, we give it a good dusting carefully. And some are broken and the pieces need to be fitted together. And that can take a long time. And we have to try and find every bit. If we're putting a vase back together, and it's broken into 100 pieces, it's a long job to fit it all back together. But it could be something from 2,000 years ago. It's worth it. Often only one or two pieces of an object are found. And the archaeologist must try and work out what it is we're actually looking at. Because instead of getting a whole object, we might only find one or two bits of it. So again, it's a wee bit like being a detective, being an archaeologist, trying to figure out what it is we're looking at. Okay, so here's a couple of artifacts. This is it's a funny old name, the Fadenmore Palstaff, okay, which is actually a type of manuscript. And it's 1,200 years old, and it was found in County Tipperary. And it closes when you finish the... it was opened on the words of a psalm. And when you're actually finishing it, what it says, the words on it are, "Let them know that you, whose name is the Lord, that you are alone, are the Most High over all the earth." So this was something that was found written in this book. And the National Museum has said that this book, this manuscript, is of staggering importance. The senior conservator who works in the National Museum said that he was transfixed with fear when he had to try and restore this manuscript because he was afraid it would fall apart in his hands. It was so delicate. But it gives us information about how manuscripts were made, about what people were interested in, what they were writing about, you know, about religion 1,200 years ago. So it was a wealth of information. And here we have some monuments from around this area. We have King John's Castle, we have Plantigory, okay, tomb, and we have Green Castle just across the water from here, over near Kilkeel. And these are all monuments. These are buildings that you have to go and visit. You can't lift them up like you can an artifact. So famous artifacts, okay? There are millions of amazing artifacts have been found all over the world. And they tell us about our ancestors. But some artifacts are more famous than others because they're unique. One of them is the Nebra Sky Disc, okay? Now, the Nebra Sky Disc is this sort of oval-shaped... it's round, but it's sort of concave dish. It's not even a dish because it's not sort of deep enough. It's like something you could imagine having on your wall, maybe. It's like a deep plate, and it's this beautiful, beautiful greeny-blue colour, and it's a bronze disc, okay? It's 3,600 years old, and... it was such an extraordinary discovery that people, archaeologists, believed when they first found it that it was a forgery. It was just seemed too precious to be real. But detailed scientific analysis revealed that it is an authentic artifact. It was discovered in Germany, and it had been ritually buried, okay, which is something that happens here in Ireland with dolmens that were mentioned earlier. It had been ritually buried in a prehistoric enclosure, which means it was before there was any written records. And it was on top of a hill, the Mittelburg. And there was also two fabulous swords found, two axes, two torques, and a bronze chisel. Now, it's about 30 centimetres in diameter, and it weighs about 2 kilograms. And it's decorated with this blue-green patina and inlaid with these fabulous gold symbols. They look a bit like the moon, the sun, and stars. So this is a very famous artefact. And then we have the Tower Brooch. I love the Tower Brooch. It's dated to the 8th century, so it's about 1,200 years old. But I love it. It's called the Tower Brooch, but it was actually found at Bettystown in County Meath. Has anyone been to Bettystown Beach? No? Yes, some of you have been there. I was there recently, actually. It's a fabulous beach in County Meath, just past Drogheda. And we have two young fellas walking along, and they uncover this brooch. And they take it home to their mum, and she's not sure what she is, and she sells it to a scrap metal dealer for a couple of shillings. And then he sells it on to another dealer, and it makes its way over time to the National Museum. It's made of cast iron and gilt silver, and it's elaborately decorated, this beautiful Tower Brooch. And the front has a series of exceptionally fine gold panels, which depict animals and are separated by studs of glass, enamel, and amber. And the back is flatter than the front. The motifs consist of scrolls and triple spirals and recall something called Latin decoration, which was in the Iron Age. And along with other treasures like the Ardagh Chalice and the Dairy na Flann pattern, the Tower Brooch can be considered to represent the pinnacle of early Irish medieval's achievements. It's absolutely beautiful, and I saw it recently in the National Archaeological Museum in Dublin. It's fabulous, guys. It's well worth a visit. And we have Omish, this wonderful place where you all live. County Loud, especially Omish and Carlingford Lough, can boast a real rich history. You have a lot of myth and legends, folklore and stories about this area. And, of course, this area includes the lovely village of Omish, which is just down the hill from here. This is the land of Cuchulainn, our most famous Irish mythical hero. Everybody in Ireland knows Cuchulainn, but this is the land he is from. And it's the home of the Brown Bull of Cooley, the place where Queen Maeve of Connacht came to capture the Brown Bull of Cooley. It's the land where Cuchulainn died tied to a rock that still stands in Knockbridge just outside Dundalk. And it's where Cuchulainn tied so that he could continue standing as he was dying. He tied himself to this rock. It's the place where the giant Fionn Mac Cuaill stood astride the Cooley Mountains and fought with Ruscar, the giant of the north, as he stood atop Slieve Bawn in the Mourne Mountains, which is just over here in Rostrava across the loch. And it's the resting place of a 7-foot Spanish princess. Does anyone know where she's buried? It's not far from here.
The Long Woman's Grave.
The Long Woman's Grave. Have you ever been there?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think of it? She was very long, wasn't she?
Yeah.
If the grave is anything to go by, it's a long grave, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're way up in the mountains, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to look at some of these legends, and we're going to talk about the surrounding area. Okay, so first of all, has anyone heard of the Fagis? Yes, could anyone tell me what they are?
The Fagis were a Gaeltacht group in Omish.
That's exactly right. They were Irish speaking here in Omish, a very well-known group. Okay, thank you. And they were a post-farming community of Irish speaking fish and fruit sellers who were displaced, taken away from their homes here in the Omish Gaeltacht. And what happened was, after the famine in the 1860s, about 90,000 people were added to Belfast's population because men and women came from a countryside that had been destroyed to work in rapidly expanding textile factories, engineering works and shipyards. And it's around this time, too, that the first mention of Irish-speaking people settled into Belfast in streets off the Royal Avenue. Oh, it was called Hercules Street then. And these Irish speakers were the backbone of a post-famine Belfast Gaeltacht. So its connection to a living, breathing Irish language community at the centre of a busy Victorian Irish city. And the most important and respected Gaelic speakers in this community were from Omish. And I have a picture here of taken in Omish of the Fagis who were selling fish and fruit down in the village. Okay, so this is a group of people very famous called the Fagis, and they were from Omish. Cúchulainn, could I have someone up here to read to our listeners in your lovely voices about Cúchulainn?
Cúchulainn was an ancient Gaelic hero warrior who was gifted with superhuman strength and speed and skill.
Very good.
Setananta was his name as a young boy at the age of 5. Setananta left home to join the Red Branch Knights, the army of King Conor Mac Nessa, who was his uncle. With him, he took his hurley, his slither, and his javelin and his spear.
Okay. Can we sum up to read the next bit?
Cúchulainn achieved his name at the age of 7 when he killed the wolf found of a blacksmith named Cúchulainn with his slither. King Conor was amazed to find his nephew alive and proud of his great strength. Cúchulainn was relieved. Setananta had survived, but also sad his hound was dead. Let me take the place of your hound until you find another one to take its place, said Setananta to Cúchulainn. Cúchulainn agreed. From that day on, Setananta was called Cúchulainn, which means Hound of Cúchulainn.
Very, very good. Would someone like to read the next bit? Yes, come on up.
Cúchulainn became the leader of the Red Branch Knights, and one of his enemies was Queen Maeve of Connacht. She was a jealous queen when she learnt of a great brown bull in Cooley, County Louth. She wanted it for her own. The chieftain of Louth refused to let Maeve have his bull, so she resolved to get it by force. Her army marched to Kells and pitched camp. Maeve sought a meeting with Cúchulainn. She offered him gold and great rewards if he would not go into battle against her. Cúchulainn refused, but Maeve secured his agreement to fight one of her heroes each day, reckoning that this was better than losing 100 every night to Cúchulainn's sling.
Very good. Okay, would someone like to come up and continue the story? Because it's great to hear all these lovely accents.
Day after day, Cúchulainn fought Maeve's warriors, overcoming Morrigu, the water goddess, and mortally wounding the hero Loach.
Yeah.
After more battles and deceitful trickery by Maeve, Cúchulainn mounted his war chariot and attacked Maeve's army. With most of her army defeated, Maeve once again resorted to single combat. She finally forced Cúchulainn's foster brother, Ferdia, to fight against him by threatening him with the spells of her
druids.
After a great fight in which Ferdia almost proved a match for him, Cúchulainn badly wounded and won the fight. While he recovered from his wounds, the men of Ulster began to collect themselves, and the two armies faced each other again. While the great battle continued, Maeve managed to steal the brown bull of Cooley, which she sent back to Connacht under escort. Eventually, Cúchulainn and the Ulster army defeated Maeve's followers and they fled.
Well done. Okay. Anyone to read the last bit for me?
Cúchulainn lived after his incredible feats of bravery, but not for long. After a period of time, the jealous Queen Maeve once again brought an army together to seek revenge. But it was only by magic that Cúchulainn was eventually pierced by his own spear. Mortally wounded Cúchulainn tied himself to a high stone. As a Gaelic hero, he did not wish to die lying on the ground. It was standing that he wished to meet his death. And even though he was
motionless
for a very long time. His enemies were afraid to approach him, and it was only when a raven landed on his shoulder that his enemies knew he was dead.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So that's the story of Cuchulainn. And as I mentioned earlier, this is Clacha Fomor's standing stone. And this is can be found between Dundalk and Knockbridge. So it's about 3 metres high, as I said already, and about 1.3 metres wide. Now, standing stones, we find these all over Ireland. We're not exactly sure what standing stones are for. Could anyone take a guess why you would suddenly come across? Now, just picture a time when there was no towns, very small settlements, people were wandering through the country, and you would find, talking thousands of years ago, or hundreds of years ago anyway, and you'd come across a standing stone. Could anyone think why you would have a standing stone? Like, what could it possibly be used for? You're coming across this big, as high as 3 metres high stone. What do you think?
To mark a landmark.
To mark a landmark, to mark something, to point out something. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yes, excellent. Okay. That's one reason. Some people say it could be for sacrifice. Some believe that they are to do with maybe calendar. We're not 100% sure, but here we have someone who has another idea, which is what I love to hear your ideas.
Like it's the ground, like to put it there so they know that it's the ground.
So it's a sort of stating the ownership of the land around it.
Yeah.
That's an idea. That's a good idea. Okay, thank you. Well, anyhow, whatever their purpose, and as I say, we're not 100% sure, this one is associated with Cuchulainn. Remember we mentioned in the story that he tied himself to the stone and that only knew he was dead when a raven landed on him? Well, this is that stone, okay? This is what legend has, is that stone. Now we have the story, it's not as long, of Finn McCool. Is there someone would like to come up that hasn't read? Would you come up and read this for us yet at the back? And this is the story of Fionn McCool, who is very well known around these parts. I grew up here in this legend. I always thought it'd be great to meet him. So if you come in and speak to us and tell us the story.
Fionn McCool was one of Ireland's most famous giants. One day he had an argument with another giant who was standing on one of the Mourne Mountains directly opposite from Slieffy, which is the chief mountain in Carlingford Range of the Mourne Mountains, and where Finn himself was standing. Finn got very angry and lifted a huge rock or stone and hurled it across the loch at the other giant, who was immediately killed, and the stone of Clockmore can be seen from the district surrounding Carlingford Loch and Omeath. Murphy, another giant, who is at present buried in Kil-Owan, which is on the county down side of Carlingford, was 8 feet and 4 inches tall and used to converse across the loch with a friend of his who lived in Omeath.
Who lived in Omeath. That's great. Thank you. So that's the legend of Finn McCool. Has anyone here ever visited Clockmore? Yes. Would you like to come up and describe it for me? Would you come up and just tell me a bit about it? So I just want to know, it's been a long time since I was there and my memory's not as good as it used to be. So does it seem very high up? Do you walk up to it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you can't drive, you have to actually walk up.
Yeah.
And is it huge?
Yeah.
Yeah. Could you like a few people sit on it?
Yeah.
Yeah? And what did you think when you saw it?
It was huge.
It was huge. I have a friend who's a geologist, and she was explaining to me, it was moved here, it was carried along on the ice and deposited here during the Ice Age. It's about 50 tons. Oh, it was supposed to have come from Scotland. That's where it was transported from on the ice. It's a venue at Easter, and I know people do this, where the residents of Ostrava go up to the stone and they roll their Easter eggs down the hill. Okay, the Long Woman's Grave. The Long Woman's Grave. Now, the Long Woman's Grave isn't far from here. Sure it isn't, guys. It's up at the top of the hill behind here. And you guys, most of you have visited the Long Woman's Grave, have you?
Yeah?
And just for our audience, so they know a little bit about her, the Long Woman's Grave is the grave of a Spanish woman who married a guy called Larkin O'Hanlon. Now, Larkin was the youngest son of the chieftain of O'Meath. And when he died, he ordered that his lands be divided between his two sons, so we'd Conog and Larkin. However, Conog tricked his brother Larkin by bringing him up to the top, with this up here behind you, up to the top of the mountain here. And he told him that he would give him all the land as far as he could see. So they start heading up the mountain. Larkin's in the best of form. He knows he can see the whole of the countryside from the top of the mountain. But mist started coming in, mist. And it was a very bleak hollow they were standing in, and it was filled with mist. So he couldn't really see anything. And his brother tricked him, and he ended up only having a few feet of land that he could see through the mist. So he was very annoyed, but he owned a ship, and he hopped on it, and he began trading in the east, and he made his fortune. He became very well off, and he was in Spain, and he met this girl called Kathleen, and she was a descendant of the great O'Donnells of Ulster, and he fell madly in love with her. And they were a beautiful couple, although she was 7 feet tall. She was only, which sounds huge, but actually he was still a bit taller than her. He was 3 inches taller than her. And they eloped, and when they arrived in Carlingford Lough, the locals were enchanted by this beautiful woman. Thought she was a big, tall, fabulous-looking woman. And covered in gorgeous jewels. Oh, they thought she's gorgeous. And the couple went along the mountain path for a walk, and they came to the spot where his brother had showed him the land, had tricked him. And again, as he approached it, Larkin said to his bride, that I am lord of everything that you can see. But the mist had come in again. And when Kathleen looked around, she was so disappointed, and she realised everything she'd left behind in Spain, and she dropped to the ground and died. And Larkin was horrified, and he flung himself into the murky waters. There was a sort of a ditch with water in it beside the hollow where he had been shown up from the top of the mountain, the land. And he threw himself into it, and his body was never found. But the locals found Kathleen, and they built her the Long Woman's Grave. They buried her in the Long Woman's Grave, and she's still there today. And everybody who went laid a stone in the grave to raise her burial cairn. Her burial sort of tomb was made up of all these wee stones. And here she sleeps till this day. Okay, so Ephulathea, this is also known as a burnt mound or an ancient cooking place. And these were a type of archaeological site found in Ireland, okay? So they would be considered a monument. In Great Britain and the Isle of Man, they're known, as I said, as burnt mounds, but we call them Ephulathea. And they survive commonly, the ones we find the most, are a sort of horseshoe-shaped mound of charcoal. And there's a heat-shattered stone in the centre of the pit. Because what they used to do was they'd dig a pit, and they'd line it with flat stones, and then they'd fill it with water, and then they'd heat stones up in the fire, and they'd throw these dead-hot stones into the Ephulathea, and it would heat the water, and they could cook in it. And the majority of them in Ireland were constructed during the mid to late Bronze Age, which is about 1500 to 500 BC. Although we have found a few Neolithic examples, which would be about 5,000 years BC old. And there are about 4,500 of them have been found in Ireland. So Pulawi Mass Rock. About a mile from the school is a big rock, and it is known among the people of O'Meath as a mass rock. It is said that long, long ago in the penal times, a priest would say a mass there, and the rock was his altar. Now, as you know, during the penal times, there was a ban on Catholic mass and a ban on sacraments, and Catholic priests and worshippers had to find somewhere to hide in the Irish countryside to celebrate mass. And many of these sites are marked with a mass rock. And it could have been a rock taken from a church ruin and used as a place of worship for Roman Catholics. Now here, the one you have near here has got a slight hollow in the centre of the rock. And it's said that there's a hollow because the priest always put his chalice there, and it eventually made this sort of hollow. The place where the rock is situated is between the Long Woman's Grave and two mountains on the outskirts of O'Meath. Now who here has ever been to the Mass Rock? Could someone come up and tell me a bit about it? Describe it to me. No, yes, could you come up and describe it to me? Yes, the Mass Rock. Because I know it's not far from here, but I haven't actually seen it. What's it like?
It's like...
Would it be as big as Clockmore?
No.
No. Okay. And is it in a field, a flat field, or is it... Where is it?
It's like kind of like on gravel, like type of... Like,
oh, type of gravel, okay. And have you ever heard of a modern Mass there? Has there ever been a Mass there in your time?
Every year.
Yeah. Every year. Have any of you ever been to it? Yes, thank you. Could someone come up and tell me about that? Thank you. So you've actually been to Mass there. Can I ask you a few questions? Would many people from around here be at the Mass?
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be packed.
Yeah.
And it's exact same as a Mass in a church, except it's outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's on the 15th of July this year.
The 15th of July. And it's got a great view from the Mass Rock. I mean, can you oversee the bay and everything like you can from the stairs?
Not really.
Not really. So it's more about concentrating on the Mass, is it, than looking at the view? I think it's wonderful because, you know, I don't know anywhere else around here that has a Mass Rock. So thank you for telling me about it. Okay, so that's the Mass Rock. And then we have, let's just see... Okay, we have Clontigory. Has anyone from here been to Clontigory? Do you know if you go over the mountain from Omi to get to Dundalk, and you can go one way by the Long Woman's Grave, and there's another road you can take that again will take you over the mountains, but it takes you out by the Carrickdale Hotel. Yes, that is where Clontigory is, okay, and it is absolutely fabulous. It's also known as the King's Ring by people from around here, and it was built for collective burial by an early farming community about 3,500 years BC. So when I say collective burial, that means that a few people were buried within this great chamber. There was a number of rooms. If you can see the reconstruction here, you can see this long, narrow building going into a point, and it's covered in stones. And there's a sort of passage in the middle way through it. And as you walk through this passage, there would be chambers off the left and right, and people would be buried to it in there, and they'd have grave goods, things that meant something to them, maybe their spears or their favourite sort of, decorated bowl or their favourite cloak, whatever. So this would be a passage chamber, and although it's quite ruined now, it's still a really beautiful sight to visit. Still very impressive with these big, big stones and roof slabs, still all there in place. Let me just see. Narrowwater Castle is one of the best preserved castles and tower houses in Ireland. It's from the 16th century, it's just down the road. Has anyone here been to Narrowwater Castle? Yeah, has anyone here been inside it? Do you know in the summer, from June to August, you can go to Narrowwater Castle. It's free to go in. There's a ranger there that will let us go and have a walk around it. And it's a lovely wee castle. It was the site of a keep built by the famous Hugh de Lacy in 1212, who built also King John's Castle in Carlingford and Green Castle. And it was to prevent river-borne attacks, people coming down the river, the canal in Uri, and attacking Uri. The tower house in Bourne, which is like a courtyard beside it, what you can see here now, was built in the 1560s. And it was built for around £350. So nowadays, that wouldn't even pay for an Xbox. But at the time, it paid for this beautiful castle, which is still wonderful today. It's got lovely features inside it. And it has four stories and then this lovely crenellated top with the wee turret. Wonderful wee castle. And then features include this matriolation. Sorry, it's four stories, but three stories and then an attic in height. The walls are about 5 feet thick. Now just think about how thick the walls are. The width of your table there. Think how much they would really keep the cold out. There's arrow loops in the castle, which are little skinny windows that were very hard to fire arrows into, but the people inside the castle had a wide window ledge and they could fire arrows out. And there was a matriolation above, so this is sort of a stone defensive feature where anyone approaching the door of the castle, they would throw stones down and hit them on the head. And they've got vaulted ceilings. They've got garderobes, which is toilets built into sort of closets as you go up the stairs. It's like a stone seat with a hole in it. It's a fabulous wee castle. And then we have Green Castle here, and it was built during the 1230s by Hugh de Lacy, who built, who would have had a keep there, where we're talking about Narrow Water Castle. And it guarded the southern approaches to the Earldom of Ulster on the eastern shore of Carlingford. It's actually, if you look at the picture there, it's actually one big building. Okay, it's not surrounded by a wall, although it would have originally had walls and towers around it. And it wasn't, it didn't originally have that third story. It was only two stories high. The third story was added on. And if you ever visited, has anyone here visited? Have you been there? If you ever visited, you can climb up to the very, very top and walk around the very top of the castle. I tried to do it, but one look over the side and I went back down the castle going, oh my God, please let me down, please let me down, because it was very, very scary. But for you young people, you could probably do it, no bother. So we're going to finish off with a quiz to see if everyone was listening. The first question is, what is dendrochronology? Can you remember dendrochronology? Okay, if anyone can guess, put your hand up and come up and tell me. Dendrochronology, my favourite word in archaeology. What do you think that was?
Is it when you count the rings in a tree?
Brilliant. Well done, okay. What were the phages? Yes, if you can come up and tell me what the phages were.
The phages were a famous Irish group, a Gaeltacht group from Omeath.
From Omeath, well done. Okay, what is a mass rock? Yes.
Where people would secretly do mass.
Secretly do mass during the penal laws. Which would take longer to decompose, a glass bottle or something made from styrofoam?
Would styrofoam take longer?
Well, funny enough, that's a good question. We know how long a glass bottle would take, probably a million years, but we don't actually know how long styrofoam would take. You would think because it's easy to break that it would decompose very quickly, but actually it takes a long, long time to decompose. So, bit of a trick question. Well done. Is Cuchulainn stone a monument or an artefact? If it's an artefact, you could pick it up and take it with you and examine it. If it's a monument, you'd have to go and see it. So, yes. So do you think it's an artefact or a monument? And we're just going to go through this quiz.
A monument?
A monument. Well done. Okay. What did Finn McCool throw at the other giant? Okay, this girl down here. Yes. What did Finn McCool throw at the other giant?
Through a giant stone.
A giant stone. Good girl. Can you remember the name of it?
Clockmore Stone.
Good girl. Okay, where was the long woman from? Yes. Where was she from?
The long woman was from Spain.
She was from Spain, correct. What is an excavation?
An excavation is where archaeologists find fossils or artifacts.
And dig them up, that's right. And the final question, why is Cuchulainn called Cuchulainn? Let's get here, yes, come on up and tell us.
Because he killed Setanta's dog,
yes.
That was called Cuchulainn, then he renamed himself Cuchulainn.
Yes, because he was going to take the dog's place until he got a new one, wasn't that it?
Yeah.
Well done. Okay, guys, I want to thank you for your patience. You were absolutely brilliant today. As usual, when we come out here to the Square Wee School, we always enjoy it. I can't describe to our listeners the view you have from here. Suffice it to say, it's the best view I've seen from any school we've visited. To look out that window and see the whole of that bay, right out to the Irish Sea, is amazing. And the wonderful mountains, every window you look out of has a different view. Honestly, it's just perfect. Thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen and all our listeners, I hope you have enjoyed our program in our series Heritage and Heroes. We've certainly enjoyed our visit here to Ardahi, and we really hope you, like the students, are learning a lot about the history of the various schools. we visit and their surrounding landscape. We'll be back next week. Thank you, Ardahi School, for having us and to all the wonderful children and teachers. We really, really hope you'll tune in. Thank you now.
This programme has been funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.